I will admit that I'm looking forward to street food and hawker stalls. That is possibly the only reason I'm excited.
Is there any other reason to go to Singapore?
A conference that people want me at, but you know. That's more their deal than mine, I suppose.
Yes. That's work.
Yeah. Actually, the best reason to go to Singapore is that I'm actually going to go to Bangkok and get new shirts made.
No. Okay.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 589 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined today by Mr. Foz Mamoon and Mr. Seth Miller. Gentlemen.
Howdy. Day.
Saturday morning. It's gorgeous weather here.
It's 45 and like borderline sleeting. Not quite, but rainy. Mount Washington's getting snow today. It's May 30th, and we're getting snow in New Hampshire.
You guys are getting Oregon weather. That's funny. I'm going to be touching. I've never been to New Hampshire. I'm going to be touching New Hampshire in June.
Uh-oh.
I'm flying into Manchester to drive down to West Boston.
That's a choice.
It's better.
Actually,
than,
not bad. It's very
far West Boston, I should say.
Yeah.
All right. Is it even Boston at that point?
No, it's not. I just can't say that. I can't say where I'm going. So. Okay.
West of Boston, not West Boston.
Yes, west of Boston. There you go, Foz. Thank you for the correction. American Airlines has hitched their horse to Starlink.
Partially.
For Wi-Fi domestically?
So it's the Airbus fleet. And so it's mostly domestic. They fly a decent amount of regional, international as well, but it's Airbus single aisle only.
So the one thing I don't understand is the worst Wi-Fi out there is the Panasonic stuff. Why are none of the airlines prioritizing that?
So Viasat, American has already announced that it's replacing the wide bodies with Viasat.
Okay.
That was announced late last year. That's an implementation problem more than anything else at this point.
Is Panasonic, that's American. Delta has Panasonic as well, or is it someone else?
No, Delta doesn't have any. No. American has it for its long haul 787-777s. United has it on some long haul still.
I think United has on all of its long haul still.
Some of United's newer planes are 77s or Viasat.
Oh, really? Okay.
And a bunch. I'm pretty sure like United's single aisle Airbus fleet was Panasonic at one point.
Yeah, that's been converted, I believe.
Right. That went to Viasat and it will go to Starlink. So it's interesting to me, the American deal, mostly because for a long time, Starlink only would sell you an airline their solution or partner with an airline if the airline went full fleet. And both Singapore and American have announced deals in the last 4 or 5 weeks that are partial fleet, which we'll see if that's just a stepping stone to full fleet or what. But that's an interesting bit to me. But yes, it's another 500 planes for Starlink.
I mean, it could be that Starlink's just like looking at it and saying, we've got a ton of planes already signed up for this. Maybe we should just hedge our bets on what our actual throughput can be if everybody signed up all their fleets.
I don't think they have that sort of mental approach to the situation.
Might have the answer to this. I guess the question that I have is, if the Airbuses already have Viasat and the wide bodies are the ones that are supposed to get new Wi-Fi, like, why not do the wide bodies with Starlink rather than the Airbuses?
So the Airbus fleet is split between SES now. I had to run through three different brand names in my mind there from a merger. The 2KU system and Viasat. Also, I think just contractual term-wise, that's up. And so it was time to make a decision there.
Got it.
And then it's... Looking back through my notes, it's been almost 10 years since the original spat with Gogo, an American. So things, you know, change quickly and slowly all at once.
So according to the UA fleet site, all the wide bodies still have the Panasonic KU stuff.
Okay.
I know the first 777-200, the GE one, the pre-merger Continental one is sitting in Rio right now getting a Starlink kit installed.
That's fun.
Have they still not figured out how to do the 787s? Or is that just requires Boeing to intervene?
It requires Boeing. Boeing Global Services contractor arm. Because Qatar has its first few 787s installed. It basically, because Boeing won't certify punching extra holes in the carbon fiber fuselage, they had to figure out a way to put the terminals on the standard mounting plate that Boeing uses for basically everything that it puts on a 787. And Boeing is moving towards a fully standardized single installation option for everything, everywhere, all the time. Anyone wants to put Wi-Fi on a plane. 787, 777X, and the MAX will be... the exterior bits will be surprisingly similar.
Interesting. Okay.
So you basically,
I guess that's a good thing. Standardization is a good thing.
It's interesting in the industry right now. It's ARINC 791 and ARINC 792 are the standards involved with what the mounting plate looks like, where the bolt holes are, you know, how big things can be, what the wiring systems look like. For a while, the industry was moving entirely towards, if you didn't have ARINC 791 or 792 compatibility, you weren't a player as an antenna manufacturer. And then people showed up and were like, yeah, but ours actually works better and it's smaller and lighter and easier to install and whatever. And people were like, oh, so there's a whole bunch of manufacturers that have ARINC 791 compatible systems. They're like, we should probably make one, a version that's also smaller and easier. And then you get a Starlink that was like, F you standards, we don't care about your world. But airlines are like, okay, but we have to install this on a Boeing plane, and this is the only way. And all of a sudden, Starlink's like, yes, we're standards compliant. We have a model that fits on the ARINC 791 platform. So, yeah, it's the last 6 months or so have been real interesting on that front.
It's funny, like all the boring stuff. You think the standards, like the boring things in every industry,
yeah.
these specifications are the things that make life easy, but at the same time are pain in the ass to read.
Yes.
Blue Origin. We talked about Leo for Delta a couple weeks ago. Delta was going with Amazon's Leo for their Wi-Fi, and Blue Origin just had an explosion on the pad. So, well, do we know the cause? Do we know why? And then what is Delta thinking right now?
We don't have cause or any sort of analysis other than it was a big boom. This was a hot fire test, so they fuel it and light it, but don't actually launch it, more or less. And all that fuel went boom.
Oh, it launched. Yeah.
Well, they do it without the payload, so the satellites are okay, but it clearly puts a kink in the launch schedule at this point moving forward.
Yeah, and it is worth noting that this was the return to launch for the New Glenn rocket from Blue Origin. They had just gotten approval from the FAA to try again, and, well, oopsie. On top of that, yes, there's also ULA, which is one of the other launch operators, is still launching satellites for Amazon. So those, like, I want to say Friday afternoon, at, like, the explosion was Thursday, and then Friday there was a launch that actually put another 40-something into service, so, or into orbit, so... Launches aren't completely stopped for the Amazon Leo system, but it's certainly was in theory dependent on having New Glenn available to continuously, you know, run these rapid launch successions process, whatever, so that they could get the 3,000 they need into orbit. And I think they only need like 1,500 to get the initial coverage, and then they're going to grow. They are well behind Amazon in getting satellites into orbit.
Well behind SpaceX.
SpaceX, thank you. They're well behind SpaceX in getting satellites into orbit. They have a plan and a whatever. They're trying to catch up. Obviously, blowing up a rocket doesn't help.
What? I mean, go ahead, Foss.
I was going to say, like, I was reading that the Blue Origin schedule launches are like 30% of the satellite capacity. that they're supposed to put out there. So that has to be a substantial impact.
Yeah. And there's also some weird stuff around. It's not just the timing of when the Constellation will be available and, you know, have enough coverage to deliver service to users, but also like when you go to build a satellite constellation, you announce to the world that you're going to do so and you apply for rights to certain spectrum through the ITU, International Telecommunications something. You get your ITU application in to have authority to use the spectrum, and there's sequences and priorities and things like that. And if you don't hit targets of deployment, they delay you. Or if you get delayed on your deployment targets, they can give that priority to someone else. So you'd be like, hey, we're putting up a global constellation. No one else should do that because we're going to have priority. And assuming you put it in place, no one else can interfere with your radio communications. But someone else could be like, all right, well, we want to be backup. And if you miss your deadlines, then in theory, ITU hands over that capacity to, or those priority rights to the backup. And let's just say Amazon Leo ain't hitting its targets based on the way things are going right now.
What about Delta? You think they regret their decision? Or do you think they're kind of sitting back? I mean, you said that they only really need 1,500 of these satellites to get coverage. What?
I mean, 1,500 is still a lot. You launch them 50-ish at a time, so you need... and I maybe have those numbers slightly wrong, but you're going to need a steady pace of like a launch a week at some point to get to a functional network. They've got 17 or 18 months and they want to 12, 18 months. They want to get there. And so, yeah, not great. But I think the challenge there for Delta is sort of, you know, it was a big deal for Amazon to sign that contract, certainly get a big name. It's the second airline committed. JetBlue was first on a small subset of its fleet. Delta also on a subset of its fleet, similar to American, doing sort of domestic-ish only. And so that helps in terms of coverage footprint. Long story, but getting to full polar coverage takes longer usually for these constellations. It's lower priority. And so, you know, does Delta regret its decision? It was something for 2 years from now anyways. And I would imagine they got a decent deal based on being a big name, being willing to announce it. So I don't know if they regret it yet. But I think that there's certainly some questions. And if things change, the good news is they can always switch. Like,
yeah.
You have a contract, but the contracts these days have enough outs. The other thing I will say is there was a whole bit between, much like with Ryanair, Musk went after Delta, calling them idiots and saying that they don't know what they're doing and blah, blah, blah. And just, I don't know. That's not the type of person I like to do business with.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me. I mean, no one's really flying polar right now, right? So that's not a big deal.
U.S. airlines and European airlines aren't flying polar right now.
Yeah.
Qatar is. Emirates is.
True.
And they want that service.
Touche. Denver. Exciting news at Denver. Something we have said should happen at Denver forever. They're getting walkways between the concourses. They are taking a disused tunnel, or I guess unused tunnel, and turning it into walkways for passengers.
Have you seen the price tag on this?
How much is it?
I read $700 million.
For an already existing tunnel?
Well, they have to close off all the hidden chambers down there, right?
Okay, but that's like a stack of sheetrock and some paint.
That's what I was going to say. Like, I can get some drywall for $700 million.
I could even get people legally certified to work on airports that cheap. Like,
yeah.
Or maybe we need to start a construction business on the side.
That'd be...
I was thinking we needed to start a fake airline to bid on LaGuardia slots, but whatever.
Dots, Lines, and Destinations could be the name of the construction company. I mean, yeah. It's not unheard of.
Some stupider thing.
I feel like, I mean, this is good. I think it's good news for passengers. The train, I was reading the stats, like the train is broken, I don't know, like once every 25 days or something.
Oh, way more than that.
More than that.
I think Ned Russell posted this. I think his story said they'd broken like 200 times in the last year.
Wow.
And maybe it's, you know, how long it was broken for and whatever, who knows, in each of the scenarios. But, like, it's a lot of documented outages.
Yeah, yeah. People are like, well, we'll finally get to see the Illuminati or something down there. So
right.
it's why was it not built with the tunnel to begin with is a big question, right? Who in their right mind thought, like, there's no extra track that they could run trains on, right? The trains run at capacity. Like, most of, like, the last few times, I hate going to Denver because if you have to connect and change concourses, you just don't know if you'll get on a train or how long you'll wait.
Well, I mean, I think it used to be that no one was expected to change concourses. It was like Southwest is all in, what is that, A? No.
Let's see.
C. United's in B, and then the international stuff was all in A.
Yeah, but now United's in A and B.
Yep. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but it's a much busier airport now than it was when it was built. And this is one of the interesting ones. I mean, we were all alive when it opened, right? Like, it was a big deal when they opened it. It's also a little funny to me because that they're using the baggage corridor stuff, that turns out to be the savior for a tunnel, because for those of us who have been around long enough, remember, the baggage handling system at official opening was a disaster. I can't remember if they actually delayed moving from Stapleton there because of it, or just things were bad for a little while at the beginning, but the original baggage system, like, they went to turn the airport on and the baggage system didn't work and it was a debacle.
At least it wasn't the, you know, fire extinguisher system.
Yeah. The lights that you could turn off in Berlin.
Yeah. We forgot to put a light switch. Yeah, I think it's cool. I think this will be good. I think it'll make Foz Connect. I wonder if they'll put in moving walkways or if they're going to make it like LAX where it's like, no, you're going to walk till your legs fall off.
I mean, hopefully it's not LAX like LAX, because that seems like a bomb shelter when you're down there.
This was one of the things that Ned raised, and he wrote a little bit about it on his Substack, I think. I can try to put a link into the show notes if I remember. It was like, what does it take to make a good tunnel experience? And there are some that are, you know, everybody talks about the United Concourse at O'Hare, right? Because they got Rhapsody in Blue playing and the lights dancing. There's a similar at Detroit. Salt Lake City has a new tunnel now between its two new piers. And then you get like the LAX experience or lack thereof. Heathrow T5 is actually somewhere in between in my mind, mostly because it's so empty. Like, the number of times I'm down there and I'm the only one.
I mean, LAX, depending on the time of day, you can be the only one, depending on where you are. LAX is just like, I feel like people get into the LAX tunnel and they're like, I'm in the wrong place.
The challenge with the LAX tunnel is, like, the paint is like renter's beige for most of it.
Yeah.
You get between 5 and 6 and you still have all the Delta signage without the Delta logo. Right, like, just it shows that they put no effort into it, and then, like, the icing on the cake is the blast doors.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, what happens if these close? Why are these here?
Yeah, what happens to me if these close while I'm down here?
Yeah, it's very true. And I think then you get to, like, what is it? Is it American's terminal? Is it 5? And they have like the new hallway that they've built, and you're like, oh, this is nice. And then it goes into some like exposed wall. And you're like, wait, am I going the right way? And if you miss a sign, you end up going the wrong way, for sure.
So, Americans also, don't you, like, you can accidentally end up in a tunnel to exit?
That's exactly what I mean. Like, if you go the wrong way, like, you're back outside of security.
Yeah.
And you're like, oops.
Atlanta also, like, big train between the planes, but also a nice tunnel system that you can walk. And they've done a good job putting, like, art and museum stuff down there. It is always interesting to me, like, the BA... T5, whatever, Heathrow, I've been through a lot lately, and I like that walk. It's nicer to me than taking the train, just because I know I'm going to be, I either just got off a plane for 6+ hours or I'm about to be on a plane for 6+ hours. And so I enjoy the walk. But the spacing of the terminals, you know, if you could walk from the AB pier to CD at Dulles, would you? That's a long way.
It's a long way.
Right. Are they spaced more than the Atlanta terminals? Like, you start getting into some of those thoughts.
Even from the train drop off.
Well, it's a temporary terminal, Stephen.
Yeah, I know, but it's still a long walk. I'm trying to think of other places what do you think about T2 at Heathrow? I know you don't go through T2 that much, but I would say it's worse than T5.
You think so?
I just think it's like kind of, it's dark.
I mean, T5 is terribly dark.
Yeah, T5 is
like weird purple accent lighting.
Yeah, that's true. It might be worse. It might be worse.
The thing I don't like about T5 is that the walkway is on a different level than the train, and you have to take the elevator to get to it.
That I would agree with, yeah.
They make it hard to get to the walkway.
They make it hard to get to it when you're out in 5B and 5C, there is an escalator.
Yeah, but when you're at the main terminal.
Yes. In the main terminal, you have to go. Also, though, the elevator's way faster, so you should always take the elevator key through. It's from departures level, quote unquote, to the train is 4 flights.
Yeah, I mean it is
-2, and then it's another 2 flights down to the tunnel.
That's even true at T2, right? Like if you come out at baggage claim,
yeah,
and then you go across the street, it's most people. The problem is I don't want to wait at the elevators because they're just a mess of people at T2. And so I'll just take the escalator. But coming back up, it's definitely faster because people don't use the if you take the Elizabeth line and you come up, it's much faster to just take the elevator. So
yeah.
Anyway, any other good tunnels, listeners? Tell us what tunnels we're missing. If anyone mentions Frankfurt, banned.
Great to jail.
Is the tunnel at Cleveland still there, or did they finally close it?
I know the one at Pittsburgh is gone, right?
Cleveland's exists because they haven't knocked down the road terminal, but no, you can go out there.
Should we talk about that? Should we talk about Cleveland and United and how they're bringing some flights back?
Are they really?
Yes.
Yeah, they announced 2 routes. What are they, Foz? Las Vegas and...
Miami and Las Vegas.
Mini-Hub is back, baby.
Okay.
Ed will be connecting there soon.
To get to Vegas. Yeah. Scott Kirby now says that he's only doing mergers with airlines that are interested, not ones that he has to do it, you know, just for talking about, so...
I mean, he is a weird dude. I mean, we'll talk about this more on the after show, but he's...
Anyway. He's saying a lot of shit lately. Anyway.
Alaska is making Exit Rows premium class, which is their more paid for economy seats.
It's what they call economy plus on their 737s, basically.
Yes. And like, so yep. It typically comes with like a free drink, I think. And it's got more leg room. That's the big thing. And so they're making their Exit Rows, which used to be just preferred seats. So if you were any elite level with Alaska, you could book those. Or you could get those at booking. The gnashing of teeth has begun, and people are already saying, well, their website claims that any person, any elite level gets these as seats. I'm like, well, they just haven't updated the website, and they're already filing DOT reports. So,
yeah. Congratulations, you made them update the website.
Wait, any elite gets a premium class seat?
No, any elite gets it says on their website explicitly, you get the exit row seats are for any elite level. So,
well, that was just things right on the website.
Yes. And then they've also switched their in-flight meals, switched the Hawaiian in-flight meals to buy on board. It's kind of a big change. Yeah,
that was a little surprising to me. Not surprising, a little disappointing. It's okay because they've got, it's an elevated experience with pre-order dining by celebrated Hawaii chefs. And fresh food. James Beard Award finalist chef Sheldon Simeon brings Hawaii's flavors on board with a new locally inspired main cabin menu.
And so is this for any Hawaiian like any route out of Hawaii?
I'm going to read the chunk of the press release. Starting July 1st, guests in main cabin on most flights between Hawaii and the U.S. continent will enjoy pre-ordered meals from a fresh chef-curated menu available for purchase.
That's kind of crazy. I mean... Those are long flights.
What's interesting is Hawaiian had, they want to make sure that you know that it's made, prepared with fresh local ingredients made no more than 12 hours before each flight.
Great.
So that's the timing on them. The other interesting thing about it is they're talking about, they have their, they do like the Club 49ers, they have a version for that for Hawaii also. You can sign up and basically like, I'm a Hawaiian, I'm Atmos Rewards member, but I live in Hawaii, so I'm special. And if I'm reading through this trying to find it. Yes, Huakai by Hawaiian members enjoyed their first 2 meals as part of the program for free. So they're basically like, you get one round trip freebie, but then you're screwed. And only if you become a member by June 24th.
I think this is a bad look, honestly. Those are long flights.
Also, breakfast is $16.
Yeah, eat at the airport, people. Even in Hawaii.
But is it that surprising? I mean, transcons, you pay. It's the same distance as a transcon.
For some of them, yes.
Yeah. All domestic Hawaiian flights excluding JFK. JFK state doesn't get it. Up to 20 hours prior to departure.
So it's not surprising, Foz, you're right. But it is, I think, disappointing. It was a differentiator for them.
Yeah.
But can't have that.
At the risk of being cynical, do differentiators actually really matter when people are buying on price?
Look, meals at mealtimes, baby.
But is it really a differentiator anymore?
I mean, I guess maybe they saw that there was a lot of waste that could have been. And so they're, I don't know.
Because I just don't think people buy thinking that they're going to get a free meal anymore. I think people are price-driven at this point, unfortunately.
I think you're probably right in most cases. I think where it hurts a little or it's challenging a little is for the people who are used to having a meal, because you have been flying. Like, if I showed up, I would have been surprised that Hawaiian gave me a meal, because I wouldn't have expected it. I don't think about it. I would have probably brought my own anyways.
Right.
But someone who flies Hawaiian, you know, back and forth between the mainland all the time, you know, they're obviously trying to get out a little bit ahead of it, but it's only a month out, trying to get that publicity out there. But like, someone who does it all the time shows up one day like, what do you mean I don't get a sandwich anymore? Well, can I buy one? No, you can only buy a snack box of shelf stable shit. Like, you had to pre-order the meal. And that's the part. And there was a little bit of a chat conversation about this online also in the last week or so about pre-ordering meals and that experience. And airlines talk about doing it to cut waste. I think that's probably does happen, but is not the reason they're doing it.
The airlines aren't accounting for irregular operations in that. And that's probably the biggest blind spot. Like, if you buy a meal and your flight gets missed or canceled, you don't get your meal and you have to go fight for a refund.
Or you're a business passenger, you know, last minute trip, and you buy the ticket 6 hours out from departure or on your way to the airport, and it's a transcon, and they're like, sorry, you don't have any food today.
Yep.
Ask me how I know. Right? I was in San Diego for work a while back, and I'd booked originally a JetBlue flight home. And the JetBlue flight was at like 2 in the afternoon, and the Alaska flight was at 8:30 in the morning. I wanted to get home earlier. I canceled the JetBlue flight. I bought the Alaska flight, but I couldn't get a meal because I did it the day of.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like the biggest downside is not being able to get a meal inside that 24-hour period in most cases. And when you get on board, you're like, oh, I am going to be hungry. Like, even if you're running late, like through the airport, and you didn't order something because you're like, oh, I'll buy something at the airport. And then you're stuck because whatever, there was traffic. It's a pretty crappy experience. Oh, we've got, you know, again, shelf stable stuff or heavy salt stuff or whatever. And
here's a heart attack box. Would you like one?
Yeah. I think that's the biggest downside. I get some of the reason the airlines do it. They're just like, hey, we want to have this already set to go.
And it's better food.
Yeah.
The paid food is better when you're paying $17 for, $17 for the crispy Mochiko chicken and garlic noodles by Chef Sheldon.
Yeah.
That is better food than you used to get in the, like, whatever was free box of slop.
Yep. Yep. I'm with you.
I just want to go back to the AirAsia model.
What's that?
The meals are like $2 each. There's 50 to choose from, and they're all delicious.
I was surprised on my flight from Singapore to Jakarta on, I don't know what time that was. What time was that, Foz? Like late? It was late, right?
It was in the evening, right?
Yeah, it was like 10 p.m. 8 p.m.? 10 p.m.? Yeah. I don't know. But the number of people who ordered meals on Scoot, like most of the plane.
Yeah. Instead of sleeping, instead of just not caring.
Yeah. I mean, I guess on that little hour and a half flight, they were like, well, we need to eat. Yeah. So it does pass the time.
Yeah, I'm laughing. I laugh a lot about this. When I did this with Linnea in 2019, late 2019, we were down there, and I think we flew Singapore, Kuala Lumpur. Can't remember where we finished. Somewhere to start a trip through Asia. Oh, Kathmandu. And I think it was on the first segment of it. I pre-ordered all the meals. And when I say all the meals, I think I had like an hour and a half flight. And I think I ordered six things for the two of us. And the flight attendant started bringing them over and like bring the first one over and then goes back to the galley and like comes back and is sort of holding stuff in her hands again and staring at me. I'm like, it's okay. We'll open more tray tables. Like, because I think I ordered them all for me. And then she's like, how are you going to fit on them? I'm like, oh, don't worry. She's going to eat with me. And I opened up Linnea's tray table and started putting the food down. Somewhere I have a photo of that. Maybe I'll see if I can find it.
A fat white guy up there is ordering a lot of food.
Bloody American.
I say American. Let's hold off on the fat, Steven.
The muscular white guy up there.
Big guy up front. Anyways.
God, so have we served him too much? Are we over-serving him? Anyway. ExxonMobil is warning of severe oil shortages in the next few weeks. So this was their CEO, I believe, coming out and saying this. And I kind of passively posted this. I mean, I think this is a sign that things are about to get really interesting. When ExxonMobil makes the statement, that's a little different than like a country or an entity saying, you know, we're low on oil. This is a refiner, one of the largest manufacturers of produced goods in the world from oil, saying things are going to get expensive.
And their explanation was basically that people are just drawing down inventories and we've got strategic petroleum reserve releases happening and that's going to have to stop at some point, right?
Yeah.
The only part of that I'm less certain of is the SPR, because at least in the U.S., the SPR has a ton still in it, and they're not releasing that much daily, but...
Are they releasing any right now, or are they, like, choosing certain weeks to release from the SPR, which is the strategic reserve in the United States for everybody?
I thought they were releasing, but I would have to double check.
I think they are. I just don't know if they're doing it daily or if they're, like, they basically are kind of doling it out as... stock goes down in certain areas of the country.
Yeah.
I have to read more, but it's kind of crazy. Like 400 million barrels have been released to try and lessen the impact of the disruptions it's kind of crazy across the world. 2 to 3 weeks is what he's saying though. So
yeah.
Brent crude up to 160 a barrel is the prediction. It's below 100 right now. It's running like 94, 95. So that's you're looking at like $9 a gallon gas if that happens.
Yeah. Crude oil per the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Crude oil in the SPR is at 365 million barrels as of May 22nd, down 9 million barrels from a week prior and down 40 million barrels from a year prior. So with 360 million, they can put out, you know, they can release 10 million a week for a while.
Yep.
And not that's forever, just, but for a while.
That's just topping people up basically like on their reserves. So I'm sure there's like some stuff coming from the tar sand still in Alaska that's feeding some of these refineries, but it's not good. I would look at, if you're looking at buying a ticket for the summer, or just past the summer, I would buy the ticket now, to be perfectly blunt. So that's just my take. I am not a lawyer, but that's what I would recommend.
Or a travel agent.
But that's just my 2 cents.
Yeah. Somehow we're also still importing 5 million barrels a day.
When was the last data refresh and when was the last importation?
This week. May 22nd, last week.
Could be Venezuela.
That or it's Canadian. They consider Canadian oils imports.
Sure.
Which I would probably think that's what it is.
Fair.
So we're going to talk about delayed sunrise, some awards and partner issues that Seth has run into. Swiss adding a new destination. Kirby's comments along with some threats from the administration on imports and immigration and yeah, all that. So if you're a Patreon supporter, stick around for that. If not, thank you for listening. We will talk to you next time. Happy travels.
Go take care.
See you later.